Welcome to Delmarva Public Radio's celebration of National Poetry Month, featuring literary biographies with Sue Ellen Thompson. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Today's talk, Marriage, Metaphor, and Mortality, The Poetry of Jane Kenyon, is the second in our series of lectures by Sue Ellen on the life and work of three great American poets, Robert Frost, Jane Kenyon, and Jack Gilbert. Sue Ellen, an important poet in her own right, has published 5 books of poetry, served as editor of the 2005 edition of the Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry, and is the recipient of numerous awards, including nomination for the Pulitzer Prize. Her poems have been read a number of times on National Public Radio's The Writer's Almanac. All 4 of the programs in this series are produced by Delmarva Public Radio with the cooperation of the Talbot County Free Library in Easton, Maryland, and the Talbot County Arts Council, which funded the original lecture series on which this program is based. All of the lectures were recorded in the Frederick Douglass Room of the Talbot County Free Library before a live audience. In her poem, Having It Out with Melancholy, Jane Kenyon reveals a lifelong struggle with what she calls melancholy. Here is the opening to that poem. When I was born, you waited behind a pile of linen in the nursery, and when we were alone, you lay down on top of me, pressing the bile of desolation into every pore. Anecdotal evidence and biographical sketches suggest that many highly creative people like Kenyon are no strangers to severe depression. We saw it in Robert Frost after the death of his wife, and biographical data suggests that depression and mania, including despair, fatigue, and suicidal thoughts, may have affected Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Charles Dickens, to name just a few writers. Many people assume from this anecdotal evidence that there must be a direct link between creativity and depression. Scientific studies are mixed in terms of a direct link. However, they do seem to indicate that while a mild or moderate depressed mood might promote creative literary work, severe depression and mania can actually be a liability to creativity. Where does Jane Kenyon fit in this spectrum? And how did her melancholy affect her poetry? Here is Sue Ellen Thompson and Marriage, Metaphor, and Mortality, The Poetry of Jane Kenyon.
I can't remember the first time I read a poem by Jane Kenyon, but given the fact that she wasn't much older than I and that we both published our first books with Boston-based publishers, I'm guessing that I might first have come across her work at the famous Grolier Bookshop near Harvard Square in the late 1980s. But the truth is, I don't remember how or when her work entered my consciousness. It was as if it had always been there. My parents, who had retired to New Hampshire in 1984, were living in Canterbury, barely half an hour from Wilmot, where Kenyon and her husband, the older and much more widely known poet Donald Hall, lived. I drove right past their road every time I made the trip from my parents' house in New Hampshire to my cottage in Hancock, Vermont, something I must have done 100 times between the 1980s and the mid-90s, but I never had the nerve to call ahead and ask if I might stop by and introduce myself. I occasionally saw the columns that Kenyon wrote for the Concord Monitor, which was the newspaper my parents devoured every morning over coffee, and my mother would faithfully clip any articles having to do with poets or poetry and leave them on the night table in the room where I slept. Many of them featured New Hampshire's favorite poetry couple. But I was just beginning to think of myself as a poet back then and simply didn't have the confidence to make a phone call or even drive past their house. It was my loss. Jane Kenyon was born in May 1947 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Her parents were not the typical young post-war couple my own parents had been, eager to buy a house and establish a secure financial base from which to raise a family. Her father had spent the 1920s playing jazz piano in Europe, and he met her mother during World War II when he was performing with a dance band at a Detroit hotel, and she was a singer in the hotel bar. When Jane and her older brother were born, their mother gave up her singing career and became a seamstress. Her father played piano for a Dixieland band and gave lessons on the side. In other words, she grew up in a house where music was more important than money. Although she lived in Ann Arbor, Kenyon's childhood home was surrounded by farms and orchards. Many years later, she would tell an interviewer, "I spent long hours playing at the stream that ran through my family's property. We lived on a dirt road near the Huron River, across from a working farm. I fell in love with the natural world. I use it again and again as a way of talking about something inward." The very few biographical sources about Kenyon tend to skip over her high school years, and perhaps for good reason. She was overweight, wore thick glasses, and was never in the running for prom queen. Like so many young people who are drawn to poetry at that age, Kenyon's life as a poet didn't really begin until she went to college. As a French major at the University of Michigan, Kenyon enrolled in Introduction to Poetry for Non-English Majors, a course taught by the poet Donald Hall. She had been writing poems since junior high school, but it was this class that transformed her love of poetry into something more serious. "What Don did," she once explained, "was to instill an appreciation of poetry, line by line, word by word." She wanted to take Hall's creative writing workshop the following year, but enrollment was strictly limited, and she had to submit a group of 5 poems to get in. "Every young poet writes a grandmother poem," Hall later said. Jane's was not generic. She got in. At this point in his career, Donald Hall was a tenured professor at the university and the author of 4 books of poetry, as well as the editor of a respected anthology. He was 19 years older than Kenyon, which would have made him a little over 40, recently divorced with 2 children. But after having her in his poetry workshop and occasionally meeting with her in his office to discuss her poems, he and Kenyon became what she later described as good friends, something more than teacher and student, but not romantic. Kenyon was actually in the process of breaking up with a boyfriend and was quite miserable, so Hall started taking her out for dinner once a week to cheer her up, and over time, they became close. It was during her college years that Kenyon first exhibited the symptoms of depression, an illness she had inherited from her father. She sought medical help, but this was in the early 1970s, and it would be more than 10 years before she received a proper diagnosis and medication. Hall was aware of her struggle and went so far as to introduce her to someone who would provide therapy at an affordable price, but this didn't cure her. Kenyon graduated with her BA in 1970 and went on to complete an MA in 1972, by which time she and Hall had fallen in love. They were married in April of that year when she was 24 and he was 43, but their former student-teacher relationship haunted their new one as husband and wife. I couldn't criticize her poems, Hall explained, because then I became her teacher. Kenyon felt so daunted by his reputation and presence in the house that she could only write when he was out of town. Hall had a sabbatical year coming up in 1975, and they decided to spend it at Eagle Pond Farm in Wilmette, New Hampshire, which had been in his family since 1865, and where Hall himself had spent many childhood summers with his grandparents. For Hall, it made complete sense. His grandmother was now in a nursing home with dementia, and his mother and her two sisters needed to raise some cash to support her. Because a textbook that Hall had written was selling well, he had enough money to offer an immediate down payment on the farmhouse and its 152 acres. Before long, his grandmother died and the farm was his. It felt like a homecoming for both of them. Hall, because he had so much family history there, and Kenyon, because it reminded her of the rural outskirts of Ann Arbor. But now she had whole days to fill and felt a certain pressure to justify her new existence as the wife of a well-known poet. "I used to work only when the spirit moved," she said, but now she began writing every day. Kenyon's and Hall's poems were very different. Hall was writing what a friend described as large, ambitious, loose-limbed poems, while Kenyon was entirely focused on writing lyric poetry, which she described as short, intense, musical cries of the spirit. He was impatient and energetic, while she was prone to depression and periods of lethargy. But they soon established a comfortable daily routine that Hall referred to as a double solitude. Each had a separate room in which to work, and mid-morning they would meet for coffee in the kitchen, exchanging a few words before returning to their desks. By the end of this sabbatical year, neither of them wanted to go back to Ann Arbor. Hall discovered a sense of wholeness in returning to New Hampshire, and Kenyon said she would chain herself to the walls of the root cellar rather than move back to Michigan. So Hall, who had two children in or about to start college, resigned his tenured teaching post. They moved permanently to Eagle Pond Farm, where he hoped to make a living as a freelance writer and poet. Once she settled into her new life at the farm, Kenyon's daily routine rarely varied. She would rise early, take their dog Gus for a walk, do some household chores, eat breakfast, and then go up the back stairs off the kitchen that led to her study, where she would spend the rest of the morning working on poems. After a break for lunch with Hall, she would return to her study. If the poetry wasn't going well, she would take up her chores again, or if the weather was good, work in the garden. When revising a poem, she would eventually reach a point where she wanted to show it to Hall. If she thought the poem was finished, she wanted his stamp of approval. If not, then she wanted his suggestions for how and where it might be improved. In return, she did the same for him. It might sound easy and comfortable, but they did not always like each other's work. Rather than being confrontational, they carried politeness to an extreme. Hall might read one of her poems and say, "This is going to be good," to which Kenyon would respond, "Going to be?" Sometimes she would find herself climbing the stairs back up to her study after one of their joint feedback sessions, thinking, "He just doesn't get it." The next day, she would take another look at his suggestions and decide, "Why don't I just type it up that way and see what it looks like?" At which point, she would find herself agreeing with him. For his part, Hall remembers watching Kenyon once as she read through his manuscript with tears in her eyes, saying, "Perkins, I don't like it." Perkins was her nickname for him, and perhaps part of the process of putting some space between her and her former teacher. He wept as well, saying, "It's all right, it's all right." By 1978, she had published her first book, From Room to Room, with Alice James Press in Boston. Soon she began meeting a few times a year with two other Alice James authors, Joyce Pezeroff of Massachusetts and Alice Madison, who lived in Connecticut. She referred to them as the committee, and it was on these two women that she relied for honest feedback. when Madison, a prolific writer, was too quick to submit her work for publication, rather than waiting for Jane and Joyce's opinions, Kenyon would gently advise her, "Let it grow in the dark like a mushroom, and don't pick it too soon." But she was still married to a far more famous poet, and it bothered her when she was treated like the little wife who wrote poetry on the side. When a New Hampshire high school inviting her to participate in their young authors program opened their letter with, "Dear Mrs. Hall," Kenyon said to Pezeroff and Madison, "Shall I kill them or just say I'm busy?" And when she accompanied Hall to Yale for a joint reading and the deputy director of the summer school fawned over her husband before turning to her politely and asking, "And how are you?" she responded flatly, "Premenstrual." Finally, when an English professor asked her if she ever felt dwarfed by her husband's reputation, she decided they should no longer give joint readings. This arrangement lasted until the late 1980s, when they did a joint Q&A at a university, and the students directed most of their questions at her, not him. "Perkins," she said, "I think we can read together now." Kenyon's first extended period of depression occurred after they had been married about 10 years. She had just finished her training as a hospice volunteer and was about to take on her first case when the news arrived from Ann Arbor that her father was dying of lung cancer. She returned to Michigan for the last 6 months of his life. When he died, she lost not just her father, but, as Hall explains it, the object of her concentrated care. Hall describes the impact this had on her. In 1982, 6 months after the death, we drank a beer one night in the small town of Bristol. As we drove back, Jane sank under a torment and torrent of wild crying. At home, she curled on the sofa in the fetal position and wept for 3 days. I wanted to hold and comfort her, as I had done earlier when she was low, but now I could not touch her. If I touched her, she would want to scream. Hall took her to the head of psychiatry at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital, where she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. A variety of medications were prescribed, and she was on one or the other of them for the rest of her life. In 1984, after a manic episode, she took lithium, which put an end to her mania but dulled her creativity. Nardil relieved her depression, but caused terrible insomnia. She had the most success with doxepin, which got her through 3 whole years without a major depression. But her body built up a tolerance to it, which meant taking increasingly larger and eventually unsafe doses. She talks about her struggle to find the right medication in a long 9-part poem called "Having It Out with Melancholy." Her depressive periods were, it seems, quite extreme. Hall once found her banging her head against the bathroom floor. And another time, after driving herself home from Concord, she confessed that she had felt the impulse to drive off the road. She also fantasized about hanging herself with a horse's harness. But medication kept her from carrying through on these thoughts. During her manic periods, which were far less common, she would become uncharacteristically extravagant and decisive. "Frugal Jane had to buy a peridot ring," Hall recounts. "Indecisive Jane, who always asked me to make choices, what restaurant to go to, which night to see the play, what book to read aloud, knew exactly what we should do, when and where. I thought, I am married to someone I don't know." During what would turn out to be her last extended manic episode, Kenyon wrote an opera libretto, which her husband describes as best forgotten, in 2.5 days. But the drugs were working, and her manic periods after this became much briefer, some of them little more than flashes. Then, in 1985, she discovered a lump on her neck. It turned out to be a cancerous salivary gland, which required surgery. Although she was only 38, this was the first in a series of illnesses that would come to define her marriage to Hall. A pivotal event of a much happier sort occurred in the late 1970s, not long after the publication of Kenyon's first book. Robert Bly, a poet who had been a friend of Hall's and had often visited his class at the University of Michigan, came to New Hampshire to see him in his new environment. According to Kenyon, I showed him some poems that I had been working on, and he read them thoughtfully, then looked up and said, "It's time for you now to take a writer and work with that writer as a master." I wasn't even sure what he meant, but I said, "I can't have a man as a master." He said, without missing a beat, "Then read Akhmatova." Anna Akhmatova, who had died in 1966, was one of Russia's most acclaimed poets. She wrote during the Stalinist period, and as a result, her work was censored, her first husband was executed, and her son was put in prison. Like Kenyon, she wrote from an emotionally dark place, but for personal and political rather than mental health reasons. And like Kenyon's, her work was characterized by economy and emotional restraint. Kenyon immediately began collecting all the translations of Akhmatova's work she could find. She didn't like most of them, describing them as word games that were more interested in preserving some semblance of the original Russian rhyme and meter than they were in reproducing Akhmatova's precise images. So she began trying to come up with her own versions, focusing on imagery rather than form. For example, Akhmatova has a poem about a woman parting from her lover with whom she has had an argument. In Kenyon's translation, the speaker says, "The glove that belongs on my right hand, I put on my left hand." As Kenyon later explained, "Can't you just see this flustered, red-faced, confused, frightened woman with a wild look on her face? It's all there in that image." For those who don't know much about the translation process, this is the way it worked. Vera Sandomirsky-Dunham, a Russian scholar who lived on Long Island and with whom Bly had collaborated in the past, provided Kenyon with literal, free verse translations of Akhmatova's poems. Then Kenyon struggled to turn that English version back into poetry. Although Dunham urged her to translate the poems in meter and rhyme so that they more closely resembled the Russian originals, Kenyon took her own path, placing the integrity of the image over all other considerations. If it was an exercise, as Kenyon originally claimed, it was an inspiring one. After working intensely on Akhmatova's poem, she said, "I began to feel some power in my own work for the first time." From Akhmatova, Kenyon learned that, in the words of Ezra Pound, the natural object is always the adequate symbol. If she could come up with the right natural object, it could embody the exact emotion she wanted to convey. It could be an owl standing on a snow-laden branch or a thimble found on a woodshed floor. In 1985, she published a book of translations called 20 Poems of Anna Akhmatova. These were eventually included both in her volume of collected poems and in 100 White Daffodils, a book of her essays, interviews, and newspaper columns. But despite the effort she put into her Akhmatova project, Kenyon's ongoing depression made it difficult for her to believe in herself and her work. In a letter to her friend Alice Madison, she wrote, "I went to Ann Arbor, helped my mother put on a yard sale, came home, and wrote a poem called Yard Sale. Boredom." On another occasion, she wrote, "I've drafted 3 shallow poems in 3 days. And on another, "My ear is not working, my poetry ear. I can't write a line that doesn't sound like pots and pans falling out of the cupboard." When one of her poems was chosen for the Best American Poetry Series in 1989, she dismissed it as being no more than memory and reportage. And when the editor of a prestigious literary magazine accepted another of her poems, she claimed the only reason he'd done so was because he'd had lunch with her husband, even though that lunch had taken place 13 years earlier. She also had a capacity for guilt that Madison called legendary. For example, in her short poem, Biscuit, she says, "The dog has cleaned his bowl, and his reward is a biscuit, which I put in his mouth like a priest offering the host. I can't bear that trusting face. He asks for bread, expects bread, and I, in my power, might have given him a stone." The guilt she experiences when confronted with her dog's trust is clear, But as Alice Madison later pointed out, Gus liked chewing stones. Spirituality also began to play a part in Kenyon's work. Shortly after settling at Eagle Pond Farm, Hall suggested they might go to the church in South Danbury, which his ancestors had founded. Kenyon was taken aback. She had not been raised in a religious household, and her first reaction was, "Oh no, stockings and a skirt." But Hall presented it as more of a social obligation, and Jack Jensen, the preacher, won them both over when he quoted the poet Rilke in his sermon. Soon they were regulars, and the experience began to change her poetry. Not long after the Akhmatova translations were published, Kenyon's second book came out. This was in 1986, when she was 39 years old. One of the best-known poems from this volume, Evening at a Country Inn, provides an excellent example of Kenyon's belief in the primacy of the image. It was written after Hall's son, Andrew, was involved in a car accident. Evening at a Country Inn. From here, I see a single red cloud impaled on the town hall weather vane. Now the horses are back in their stalls, and the dogs are nowhere in sight that made them run and buck in the brittle morning light. You laughed only once all day when the cat ate cucumbers in Chekhov's story, and now you smoke and pace the long hallway downstairs. The cook is roasting meat for the evening meal, and the smell rises to all the rooms. Red-faced skiers stamp past you on their way in. Their hunger is Homeric. I know you are thinking of the accident, of picking the slivered glass from his hair. Just now, a truck loaded with hay stopped at the village store to get gas. I wish you would look at the hay, the beautiful, sane, and solid bales of hay. Here again, it is a natural object, a single red cloud impaled on the town hall weather vane, along with the bucking horses and the smell of meat that prepares us for news of the accident. But it is really the beautiful, sane, and solid bales of hay at the end that carry the weight of Kenyon's heartfelt wish for her husband's peace of mind. A number of the poems in The Boat of Quiet Hours reveal a growing awareness of Kenyon's depression. I'd like to take a quick look at just two of these. First, the aptly named Depression in Winter. There comes a little space between the south side of a boulder and the snow that fills the woods around it. Sun heats the stone, reveals a crescent of bare ground, brown ferns and tufts of needles like red hair, acorns, a patch of moss, bright green. I sank with every step up to my knees, throwing myself forward with a violence of effort, greedy for unhappiness, until by accident I found the stone with its secret porch of heat and light where something small could luxuriate, then turned back down my path, chastened and calm. This is actually one of the more hopeful poems in this volume. There is that secret porch of heat and light where something small could luxuriate that rescues her from her headlong rush toward unhappiness and sends her back down the path, chastened and calm. But in this poem, the natural object, the boulder, expands into an entire house with a front porch, a patch of bright green moss for a lawn, and colorful gardens filled with ferns and pine needles. She stumbles upon it by accident in the midst of a depressive episode, and it saves her, just as poetry did so often in her life. Now let's take a look at Things, the last poem in the book. The hen flings a single pebble aside with her yellow reptilian foot. Never in eternity the same sound, a small stone falling on a red leaf. The juncture of twig and branch, scarred with lichen, is a gate we might enter singing. The mouse pulls batting from a 100-year-old quilt. She chewed a hole in a blue star to get it, and now she thrives. Now is her time to thrive. Things, simply lasting, then failing to last. Water, a blue heron's eye, and the light passing between them. Into light all things must fall, glad at last to have fallen. It is not just the natural object, a small stone falling on a red leaf, but the sound it makes that embodies the task of the poet, which is to find the words to capture the momentary. It is also the poet's task to examine the natural world so closely that even its most minute and easily overlooked details, the place where twig and branch join and then diverge, become portals through which we can enter a kind of heaven, a world beyond the literal. But as a poet myself, I can only imagine how thrilled Kenyon must have been to come up with that image of a mouse chewing a hole in a blue star in a 100-year-old quilt. This is a perfect metaphor for what Kenyon herself struggled to do. If poetry was what she wanted, she had to fight her way through her own depression to get to it. She had to reach beyond it to find something that would shelter and sustain her, at the same time knowing that one day her struggle would end and she too would be glad at last to have fallen. The well-known writer Wendell Berry counts this poem among his favorites. Jane Kenyon's work doesn't demand great intellect or learning or even sympathy, he says. It demands quiet. It demands that in this age of political, economic, educational, and recreational pandemonium, one must somehow become quiet enough to listen. Kenyon's next book, Let Evening Come, came out 4 years later in 1990. But by this time, there was another disturbance in the calm at Eagle Pond Farm, Donald Hall's discovery in 1989 that he had colon cancer. Her own brush with cancer 5 years earlier had not been entirely forgotten, but this was far more serious, especially when it metastasized to his liver 2 years later. He was now in his early 60s, and colleges and universities began holding what amounted to memorial services for him. He had surgery to remove a portion of his liver, and the chemotherapy that followed made it difficult for him to keep up with his busy schedule of travel and readings. "Our conviction of my imminent death lived just underneath the good day's skin," he said at the time. However, against all odds, he managed to survive and even grow stronger. The title poem of Let Evening Come, Kenyon later confessed, was written quickly. "While I was in Ann Arbor," she wrote Alice Madison, "I heard my mother say, 'Let evening come.' We were talking about getting depressed as the day goes on and wanting bedtime to come so you can become oblivious. I think 'Let evening come' is going to be my title." Let the light of late afternoon shine through chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down. Let the cricket take up chafing as a woman takes up her needles and her yarn. Let evening come. Let dew collect on the hoe abandoned in long grass. Let the stars appear and the moon disclose her silver horn. Let the fox go back to its sandy den. Let the wind die down. Let the shed go black inside. Let evening come. To the bottle in the ditch, to the scoop in the oats, to air in the lung, let evening come. Let it come as it will, and don't be afraid. God does not leave us comfortless, so let evening come." There's something soothing and consoling in that repeated phrase, something that imposes a sense of order and acceptance on what we might otherwise be tempted to struggle against. Perhaps this is why this poem is so often read at funerals and memorial services. Although, as Donald Hall is quick to point out, those who translate evening immediately into death are missing the poem's point. There is peace, she is saying, whether the light rises or falls. The early 90s were, in the words of the poet Liam Rector, the years of triumph for Hall and Kenyon. Bill Moyer's hour-long documentary about the couple, A Life Together, which can be seen on his website and elsewhere on the internet, was broadcast on public television and received an Emmy Award. Hall and Kenyon were also invited to the well-known Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival in New Jersey, where they were greeted as celebrities and where they performed together, which was now their habit. The Boston Globe and literary magazines featured articles about their poetry partnership, and at the invitation of the State Department, they toured India together. Let Evening Come was followed in 1993 by Constance, Kenyon's fourth book. It was in Constance that depression emerged as a major theme, causing some critics to compare her work to that of Sylvia Plath. But Kenyon's poems, as we've already seen, were reserved while Plath's hovered on the verge of hysteria. They may have suffered from related mental health issues, but their responses as poets could not have been more different. The return of Hall's cancer turned out to be merely the warning shot. Barely 2 months after Moyer's documentary was aired on PBS in late 1993, Liam Rector invited Kenyon to visit the writing seminars at Bennington College, which he directed. Because teaching terrified Kenyon, she was told she could do whatever she wanted. Instead of conducting workshops, she did readings and lectures on Elizabeth Bishop, Anna Akhmatova, and John Keats. There was not a dry eye in the place, Rector later recalled. She simply read the poems beautifully, slowly, and talked about what they meant to her. After her final Bennington reading, Kenyon told Rector she was feeling tired. She had a cold, and by the time she got home, thought she might be coming down with the flu. Hall, meanwhile, was at a conference in South Carolina. He checked in with her by phone twice a day, and was concerned when she complained of what she described as bone pain, as well as a nosebleed that landed her in the emergency room. She was still awaiting the results of her blood work, but Hall was already on high alert. He heard the words flu symptoms, nosebleed, and blood work, and immediately thought leukemia. Kenyon picked up on the anxiety in his voice and began to feel frightened herself. After hanging up, she called a neighbor and asked her to come over for tea. The doctor called while the neighbor was still there. He told Kenyon to go immediately to Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital, where he had a room waiting. Hall, who was on his way home from the airport when he decided to make a quick stop at the hospital in New London, New Hampshire, to visit his mother, was sitting at her bedside when Kenyon's doctor called to say that Jane had acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the kind children typically get and from which they frequently recover. But the prognosis for a 46-year-old woman was not nearly as optimistic. Their peaceful routine at Eagle Pond Farm was rudely disrupted. Now the schedule was nausea and dread, elevators and cafeteria boredom and panic and occasionally relief, Hall remembers. He rented a room at a nearby Days Inn so he could run to the hospital every morning, taking periodic breaks to visit his mother in another hospital some miles away. One morning, he found Kenyon wide awake and unusually restless. Using a walker, she was able to take a short stroll with him to the double door that led from the hospital to the winter day outside. Hall noted that, like an animal, Jane sniffed the fresh cold air of the world. Polly Kenyon, Jane's mother, had already moved from Michigan to New Hampshire to be near her daughter, and now she volunteered to house-sit and care for their pets. Despite how ill she felt, Kenyon still managed flashes of grim humor, as this one duly recorded in her notebook. In the shower this morning, fists full of my hair, looks as if a deathly battle between two minks had occurred. What was left of that dark, luxuriant hair with its wide white streak that her husband had so often praised fell to the floor when she asked the hospital barber to shave her head. It did seem, for a while at least, that she was responding to the chemotherapy. On February 24, 1994, she was declared to be in remission and was discharged. Kenyon and Hall returned to Eagle Pond Farm, although the drugs on which she had to remain, in combination with the psychotropic drugs she was already on, triggered periods of mania, delusion, and even psychosis. Prednisone changed her face and body as well. Her legs got thinner, and her face and upper torso got puffy. Still bald, she looked in the mirror one day and declared, "I am Telly Savalas." 2 months later, Hall's mother died. They were both deluged with messages of hope from their friends and other poets. The letters and cards that Hall hated most were those that tried to reassure him that everything was going to be fine. "The writers knew no such thing," he says. They just wanted to change the subject, and there was no other subject. Kenyon had been told that because she possessed something called the Philadelphia chromosome, which does not respond to chemo or radiation, a relapse was likely. That is exactly what happened, and Kenyon re-entered the hospital for more chemo, which weakened her to the point where she could no longer get out of bed. The doctors recommended a bone marrow transplant, but Dartmouth-Hitchcock only did autologous transplants, meaning those that used a patient's own bone marrow. Hers could not be used, so she had to find a donor and a hospital that would perform the procedure. They decided on the Fred C. Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, known as the Hutch. It was a place for hard cases, Hall said, and Jane's was a hard case. By late August, they had found a donor. The Hutch wanted Kenyon to fly out in late September to begin preparing for the procedure. Whatever momentary joy this might have brought her was erased by the news that her mother, Polly, had been diagnosed with lung cancer. It was hoped that she could be treated in Seattle while they were there, but this plan was abandoned when they found out that it would take at least 3 weeks to put Kenyon back in remission before her transplant, and this would have to take place at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. Polly, of course, couldn't wait that long to begin her own treatment. They would need to find an apartment in Seattle anyway, and they hoped that Polly could join them there once she had recovered sufficiently from her own chemo and radiation. Let's pause for a minute to retrace this series of medical events, all of which occurred over a period of 8 years. After Jane's salivary gland cancer in 1985, came her husband's colon cancer in 1989, followed by the removal of half his liver in 1992, then Jane's leukemia diagnosis in 1993, the same year as the death of Hall's mother, and the diagnosis of Polly Kenyon's lung cancer. And now, in the autumn of that year, Jane Kenyon was facing a bone marrow transplant. A second remission was achieved, and Hall and Kenyon flew to Seattle. Here is Hall's description of what their life there was like. We lived in an apartment on a street of the city, but our only address was leukemia. We woke and ate breakfast and showered in leukemia. We walked around the block, keeping up our strength in leukemia's neighborhood. We slept in leukemia all night, tossing and turning with unsettling dreams. The news that Polly's cancer had spread to her other lung was a blow to their morale. Although they phoned Polly every day, they usually ended up speaking only to her nurses. Hall remembers how affected Kenyon was by her mother's struggle. Jane lay on her back, staring at the ceiling or curled like a fetus. Her mother's condition carried her into the darkest place, like the old endogenous depression. Later, when she remembered this time, she said, "That's when I wanted to die and be with my mother." Although Polly struggled to stay alive long enough to see her daughter return to New Hampshire, she didn't make it. When the phone call came to tell Kenyon that her mother was gone, she said simply, "Good." She knew how it felt to wish for one's own suffering to end. Kenyon had the transplant in October, and by February 1995 was able to fly home to New Hampshire. Although she was very weak and frail and had to use a wheelchair, she was welcomed at the airport by overjoyed friends and family members. Once again, that joy was short-lived. Kenyon experienced severe abdominal pain and had to have her gallbladder removed. She lost more weight and her recovery stalled. Although her blood counts looked good for a while, by early April they were rising again and she began to feel bone pain. After more blood work a week later, she and Hall were shown into a private consultation room at the hospital. "I have terrible news," the doctor told them. "The leukemia is back. There's nothing to do." Kenyon's only response was to ask, "Can I die at home?" She spent what little time and energy she had left working with Hall to put together a volume of her new and selected poems, which Grey Wolf Press had encouraged her to do and promised to publish. She hadn't really written any new poems since her diagnosis, with one exception, The Sick Wife, which she wrote after returning from Seattle and while recovering from gallbladder surgery, although she agreed to have it included in this new volume, to be titled otherwise, Kenyon did not consider it finished. Hall remembers returning from a basketball game with his son and finding the poem, which his wife had dictated to a visiting friend, on the night table when he asked her why she hadn't waited for him to come home so he could write it down for her. She hesitated. Was it because she was afraid he wouldn't find it good enough? I thought of that, she confessed, her old self-doubt resurfacing. It was left out on the table for the next several days, and she would occasionally ask him to change a word or phrase. It would be her last poem, and she agreed to let it be included in the volume they were putting together. The Sick Wife. The sick wife stayed in the car while he bought a few groceries. Not yet 50, she had learned what it's like not to be able to button a button. It was the middle of the day, and so only mothers with small children or retired couples stepped through the muddy parking lot. Dry cleaning swung and gleamed on hangers in the cars of the prosperous. How easily they move, with such freedom, even the old and relatively infirm. The windows began to steam up. The cars on either side of her pulled away so briskly that it made her sick at heart. It may not be one of her best poems, but this has all the earmarks of what makes Kenyon's work so memorable. First, that simple motion of which she is no longer capable, buttoning a button. Then the dry cleaning, swinging and gleaming on hangers. What better metaphor for the ease with which those in good health move through their days? And those cars on either side pulling away so briskly, isn't that what even close friends sometimes do when one is terminally ill? The heart sickness Kenyon feels at the end is an illness of a whole different order. Kenyon and Hall worked in a frenzy on the manuscript for 11 days. He rarely left her side, and during this period, they also managed to plan her memorial service and write her obituary. When that was finished, Kenyon couldn't help exclaiming, "Wasn't that fun working together?" As Hall later described it, her faculties diminished, disappearing like lights going out on a hillside across the valley. She had recently been appointed Poet Laureate of New Hampshire, and the day before she died, she received word that 5 of her unpublished poems would appear in the New Yorker. Then, on April 22, 1995, barely 3 months after her own mother's death, Jane Kenyon was gone. When I visited my parents in New Hampshire a few weeks later, I found the Concord Monitor waiting on my bedside table. "Poet Jane Kenyon dies at her home in Wilmot," the front page headline proclaimed. Obituaries also appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. It would be almost a year before Gus, the dog, would stop fetching her slippers from the bedroom. Hall, who had expected to die in his 60s, let his hair and beard grow wild. He would outlive his wife by 23 years, dying in 2018 at the age of 89. When Bill Moyer's documentary about Hall and Kenyon was broadcast on PBS, Kenyon was, in Hall's words, at the height of her powers, energetic and confident with the beauty that accrued to her in her 40s. The film ends with a shot of Kenyon and Hall walking Gus through a meadow and over a hill as Kenyon reads her poem, "Otherwise." "I got out of bed on 2 strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birchwood. All morning, I did the work I love. At noon, I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls and planned another day just like this one. But one day, I know it will be otherwise." She did know. As Kenyon often pointed out when talking about that final shot in the Moyers documentary, it was her head that disappeared behind the hill first. On their joint headstone in the Proctor Cemetery in Andover, New Hampshire, are the lines she wrote in 1992 when her husband was ill. I believe in the miracles of art, but what prodigy will keep you safe beside me? The purpose of poetry, Kenyon once said, was to tell the entire truth about what it is to be alive. Poetry has an unearthly ability to turn suffering into beauty. She went on to explain that the poet has to console in the face of the inevitable disintegration of loss and death. That consolation, she believed, came in the form of one soul extending to another and saying, I've been there too.
Let me ask you, Sue Ellen, has Jane Kenyon was, I get a sense from your lecture that she was intimidated by her husband and his fame and carried a bit of self-doubt that intimidation may mm-hmm. have fueled some. So my question is really, has Jane Kenyon's poetry today eclipsed that of Donald Hall?
Some would say yes. I mean, he published so many books, and you know, she published just a few, just four, really. And I would say that her work has endured beyond what anybody might have expected for a poet who died so young, having published only a few books. It is largely a matter of taste, of course. Donald Hall also wrote, you know, nonfiction and essays and many books of memoir about her and poems about her. His talent is broader, you might say, but she mastered a particular type of lyric poem, and for that, I think her fame will endure.
Let me ask another question. In my introduction, I mentioned that depression is not a stranger to creative, very creative people. Is there a particular role that you believe that her bipolar condition, and which is extreme mm-hmm. depression, in mm-hmm. fact, played a significant role in her creative energies, or, as is often the case, was it a debilitating depression that she suffered?
Well, there's no doubt that she went through periods when she could not write because she was so depressed. But on the whole, depression drove her inward, which is where she found her most memorable poems. So I guess you could say it was both an aid and a hindrance.
Will you read one last poem, Sue Ellen, to close out our program?
Okay, this is my favorite Jane Kenyon poem, Happiness. There's just no accounting for happiness or the way it turns up like a prodigal who comes back to the dust at your feet, having squandered a fortune far away. And how can you not forgive? You make a feast in honor of what was lost and take from its place the finest garment, which you save for an occasion you could not imagine, and you weep night and day to know that you were not abandoned, that happiness saved its most extreme form for you alone. No, happiness is the uncle you never knew about, who flies a single-engine plane onto the grassy landing strip, hitchhikes into town, and inquires at every door until he finds you asleep mid-afternoon, as you so often are during the unmerciful hours of your despair. It comes to the monk in his cell. It comes to the woman sweeping the street with a birch broom, to the child whose mother has passed out from drink. It comes to the lover, to the dog chewing a sock, to the pusher, to the basket maker, and to the clerk stacking cans of carrots in the night. It even comes to the boulder in the perpetual shade of pine barrens, to rain falling on the open sea, to the wine glass weary of holding wine.
Thank you, Sue Ellen, for an insightful and moving lecture on Jane Kenyon. And a special thanks to our audience here in the Frederick Douglass Room. We greatly appreciate your participation. Please tune in next week for the third in our series of lecture by Sue Ellen in celebration of National Poetry Month. Sue Ellen will return to the life and poetry of Robert Frost, recounting his great friendship with British poet Edward Thomas. Thanks to all of you for listening to this Delmarva Public Radio presentation, Literary Biographies with Sue Ellen Thompson. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.